come on, need to be trained, need to get that experience. And in fact, you'll see today that the new board chair is here today, even though he does not start work until, I believe, a week after next or sometime February 5th or something, but he has been confirmed by the Senate. And the only budget issue I want to make sure you see that is brought up is the Attorney General charges in this agency represent a large share of their budget, even though they do not control that budget to a large extent, because these are challenges to their findings and their decisions. And for that reason, they take what they get in terms of what they have to purchase legal services from the Attorney General. The budget does reflect additional resources that were added by the E-Board in terms of their base budget, but since they do have little control and since it is a vital part of their budget, they could be challenged during the biennium on their Attorney General fees or costs. So I'll just outline that to you, and I'm sure they'll bring that up in terms of their presentation. In terms of presentation materials, there is a notebook in front of you, which is a presentation document, and behind you on the table over here is the formal governor's recommended budget binder that's available for you. And I would suggest that taking back up to your office if you don't use it during the hearing. But the agency will use this document at this time to go through. And if you do take it up to the any of these documents, just a reminder to your offices, we do not have, excuse me, don't mean I'm choking up here about this, but we do not have storage or space in the room, and you need to bring it back every time we hear this budget. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm completed.
Great. Mr. Powers, would you please come forward and present the testimony?
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Stephen Powers, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to present the agency overview and talk about the particulars of the budget, even though I won't start my position, as Doug just indicated, until February 5th. With me today is the acting chair of the board, Darcy Baker, comes to the board with 25 years as a parole and probation officer in Clackamas County, and board member Candace Wheeler, who, in addition to having a social work background, comes to the board after serving as a paralegal and my colleague at the Oregon Department of Justice. Additionally, our executive director, Aaron East, is with us today as well. For today's presentation, I'll start with a brief agency overview, then move to a discussion of the budget drivers, and then address the results and changes of the performance measures. Finally, I'll address the prioritized list of functions, which relate to the board's seven statutory functions, and give an overview of the quality and improvement efficiency concepts. Of course, all this information, as Doug's mentioned, is in our notebook, and I'll reference specific pages as necessary, but for those of you who are going to follow along, my presentation does go in order of the material in the notebook. The Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision dates back to 1911. In its current form, the board consists of three members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and operates under authority of Chapter 144 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. Although it does not encapsulate all of its statutory functions, in general, the board has three broad areas of responsibility. First is its release authority. Second, it's setting the conditions of community supervision. And third, issuing orders related to an offender's transition to the community. Let me go through each of those a little more in detail. The release authority is for specified offenders. There's three categories. Criminal offenders whose criminal conduct occurred prior to November 1st, 1989. This is what we refer to as matrix offenders. The second category is those who have been sentenced by trial court as dangerous offenders. And the third category is those convicted of murder or aggravated murder and eligible for parole. So those three categories taken together are what the board has release authority over. The second broad area of responsibility is setting the conditions of community supervision. These are for all inmates released from prison regardless of when they committed their crime. Additionally, this includes designating those offenders who meet the legal requirements as predatory sex offenders. The third broad area of responsibility is issuing orders related to an offender's transition to the community. Those include notifications to victims, district attorneys, and other partners in the criminal justice system, issuing arrest warrants for offenders who have absconded from supervision, imposing sanctions for violations of the supervision conditions, and possibly revoking parole or post-prison supervision, and finally, determining whether discharge from parole supervision is compatible with public safety and or required by law. So over the years, and reflecting changes in sentencing policy, the board's focus has shifted from determining when an inmate are released from prison to approving community to approving release plans, imposing conditions of community supervision, and such. Concomitantly, the board's day-to-day role has shifted from hearings with inmates from 5 days a week in 1989 to just 1 day a week today. Board members now have daily contact with institutional counselors, parole officers, Department of Justice attorneys, and staff to discuss individual cases and coordinate effective uses of its resources. The board, which had 5 members in 1989, has decreased to 3 today, and the number of support staff has decreased from 19 to 11, or in terms of FTE, from 24 to 15. That's a decrease in 38% over the last 10 years. So let me just summarize this brief agency overview by reiterating the board's mission, which is to work with partnership with the Department of Corrections and local supervising authorities to protect the public and reduce the repeat criminal behavior through incarceration and community supervision decisions based on applicable laws, victim interests, public safety, and recognized principles of offender behavior change. I won't go through a more detailed history of the board, but that's provided to you on page 3 of the notebook, nor will I list individually each interest group and customers that the board has identified on page 4 of the notebook. Let me just say that the board understands its role as a strong partner in the arena of public safety. It cannot do its work effectively without communicating with and sometimes acting in concert with its partners. Thus, it's critical that the board, and in particular the board members, have the opportunity and ability to maintain these connections and continue to reach out to its public safety partners, both for the benefit of the board's work and for the benefit of the people of the state of Oregon whom we all serve. So turning to the key budget drivers, they're on page 5 and 6 of your notebook. There are 3 key budget drivers that the board has identified. The first is the inmate and offender population. The second is the attorney general expenses. And the third is the professional services and purchasing contracts. Given the board's responsibilities that I've discussed, it's easy to see that an increasing number of prison inmates is a key budget driver for the board. As the prison population increases, so too does the number of inmates transitioning to the community. As I think you've already heard, the inmate population is projected to grow 5.6% during the 07-09 biennium, reaching 14,180 by July 1st, 2009. Additionally, as you might expect, the offender population on parole and post-prison supervision will increase. It's expected to grow 3.1% during the 07-09 biennium, reaching 13,592 by July 2009. Comparing the 03-05 biennium to this biennium, the board's workload has increased to include an increase in 6.5% in orders of supervision to an average of 450 a month, a 9.4% increase in the number of warrants to an average of 485 per month, an 8.4% increase in the number of sanctions and revocations imposed to an average of $765 a month, and a 5.8% increase in the number of discharge orders to an average of 270 a month. Thus, although the number of matrix offenders, again those that committed their crime before November 1st, 1989, will continue to decrease, the rise in the number of inmates will result in a rise in the board's workload, given the board's responsibilities when an inmate transitions to the community. Turning to the second key budget driver, because an offender has the legal right to seek judicial review of any board decision that adversely affects or aggrieves the offender in the Court of Appeals, the board's attorney general expenses continue to be a budget driver. The board's attorney general's expenses arises out of litigation from inmates or from released offenders and is not controlled by the board. As explained on page 6 of your notebook, the eighth quarter of the 03-05 biennium resulted in billings that were more than the board had in its budget and was ultimately covered by an increase from the emergency board in April 2006 and by vacancy savings. The additional funding from the emergency board was built into the 07-09 budget, but the amount covered by vacancy savings was not. Thus, it's possible that the board will again face a shortfall in its attorney general expenses, but the board is taking steps to manage its expenses more efficiently. As I'll explain later in the quality and efficiency improvement section, we're working with the attorney general on that very topic. Currently, the funds received to pay attorney general costs represents 22% of the board's total budget and 57% of the total services and supplies budget. The final budget driver identified by the board is the professional services and purchasing contracts. Page 6 of your notebook lists the contracts the board has in place for this biennium, and the board expects to continue those contracts into the 07-09 biennium. Although I won't detail each contract with you or each category of contract, you'll find that the contracts tie directly to the board's statutory duties. I would also note that the board does enter into intergovernmental agreements with 12 counties to perform parole and post-prison supervision violations hearings on behalf of the board. And another set category of contract is the category of personal services contracts for sex offender evaluations to evaluate the current risks of offenders who will be released on parole or post-prison supervision to engage in new sex-related criminal behavior. Those evaluations form part of the information that the board uses to determine whether to use the predatory designation for certain offenders. Turning now then to the performance measures, the results and changes tab, please.
Ms. Fox, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before we left the budget page there, first, welcome to your new role. Congratulations. And then we'll barrage you with questions. You mentioned that the AG billing was higher. Emergency board brought some relief to that. But the vacancy savings, you have authority for 15 FTE. How many folks? What was the vacancy? Was it FTE vacancy? Is that what it, is that?
That's my understanding that it was, you know, need to turn around and check, but it was vacant, FTE vacancy, just transition between someone leaving and then someone coming, and so that's the type of vacancy savings. It wasn't a drop in FTE.
Just as a brief follow-up, was it for the whole year, a whole position? I mean, what percentage of the, let me ask it a different way, what percentage of the billing that was additionally billed from the AG's office was covered by vacancies versus what part did E-Board come to the rescue with?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, I don't believe we have that information at hand, but we can bring that back to you either for our work session or individually. But just so I'm clear, it's the what percentage of billing was covered by the vacancy as opposed to...
And what I'm finally getting at, with a 15 FTE, you know, every person that's gone is 6% or 7% of your staff. So I'm just wondering how many people were actually gone, how much of this difference was made up by FTE savings versus what eBoard came to the table with.
Okay. We will bring that back.
Great.
Those numbers.
Please continue.
Thank you. So turning to the performance measure results and changes tab, this is pages 7 through 12 of your notebook. They link to Oregon benchmark number 65 relating to adult recidivism, which is the percentage of paroled adult offenders convicted of a new felony within 3 years of initial release. According to statistics from the Department of Corrections, the recidivism rate fell during 2006 fell to 28.6%. Stated somewhat differently, over 71% of released adult offenders did not commit a new felony within 3 years of his or her release.
Can I ask a question about that, Mr. Powers? I want to clarify that. On that recidivism, and maybe you don't know the answer to that, my understanding is that that's the recidivism rate for people on their first time into the Department of Corrections. Do you have any idea if my impression is correct?
Chair Shields, I don't. And let me make sure I'm hearing the question correctly, that it's only their first time being released.
No. Yeah. Well, their first incarceration. That's who they count in that 28.6%. But I wanted to make sure. That's just something that I seem to recall from my understanding in the past, that it's not all offenders who release. It's kind of a subset that they being released for their first time. Could you check into that?
I definitely. I will.
And then get it to Deb Wilson. And
okay. And I guess I can forward all our questions to Doug.
To Doug,
yeah,
we'll
to
it, right.
Doug Wilson.
Thank you.
This is the benchmark. Mr. Chair, can I? Now I'm confused. Are you saying that they different statistics say if somebody is in prison for the third time, then they would count differently on recidivism stats?
That was my understanding, that they wouldn't go into the 28.6% if they'd been in three times before and then they come back a fourth time.
That's not a rolling number.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, we'll make sure and get back to the committee on that.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine. The board has 8 performance measures linked to its goals and missions. A 9th measure, the best practices measure, is being proposed for the 07-09 biennium, and the board established a new customer service measure for the 05-07 biennium. For fiscal year 05-06, the board met 4 of its 7 targets established for each measure. One measure did not have a target because it's new, and the measurement will begin for 06-07, for fiscal year 06-07. Let me start with the 3 measures that were not met. On page 10 of the notebook, we've explained the key performance measure number 1 was narrowly missed by about 1.1%. This is measuring the percentage of matrix inmates. Again, those are the offenders who were committed their crimes before November 1st, 1989. Dangerous offenders, and aggravated murderers convicted of a new felony within 3 years of initial release. This is a subset of the recidivism data of Oregon benchmark number 65, and this benchmark helps the board evaluate recidivism rates for offenders for which the board has release authority for the board. It's worth noting that the recidivism for this population has been substantially lower than other inmate offender populations. For 2004, the target was 11%, and the actual was 6.1%, and so being lower than the benchmark is better in this category. For fiscal year 2005, the target was 10.5%, and the board slightly missed it with 11.6% of these matrix offenders convicted of a new felony within 3 years of their release. Finally, I'd note that this pool is a small pool of offenders. We're talking about 71 being released in the second half of 2002 and the first half of 2003, and then projecting that out for the 3 years. And so of those 71 that were released in that time frame, 8 were convicted of a new felony within 3 years of their release. And so the missing its target, but it was by one offender.
Mr. Chair, if you want the more detailed on the benchmarks, under tab appendix A is the Form A benchmark report. So the targets that you were talking about are listed there for each of the benchmarks. Just a little perspective.
The second key performance measure that was not met was number 3, which is page 3 of your appendix A. This measures the percentage of active registered victims for which the board has an accurate point of contact for notifications of hearings and of an offender's release. The board receives victim addresses directly from the victims or from victim advocates. Since establishing a full-time victim advocate in 2003, we've seen an upward trend in accurate and current victim addresses. But we did miss our target by 2.74%. Some of this information becomes stale because of the length of the offender's incarceration and victims moving, or sometimes victims just don't want to be contacted. In any event, the board will continue to work with District Attorney's Victim Advocate Offices and our other partners to create a seamless system of victim services throughout the criminal justice process. The final KPM that was not met was number 7, which appears in Appendix A at page 5. And this measures the percentage of administrative review responses completed and mailed within 60 days of receipt of the request for administrative review. Administrative review is the first step for an inmate or an offender seeking judicial review of a board's order in the Court of Appeals. Because in part of board member vacancies, the board has had a substantial backlog in responding to administrative review requests. In March of 2006, the board had 427 requests for administrative review that were beyond the 60-day mark. There's a chart showing the backlog on page 11 of our notebook. In December of 2006, that backlog was reduced to 5 requests that were beyond the 60-day mark. So there's been substantial gain in reducing that backlog. As you know, the board has had 2 members since December of last year and January of this year, and so the number of administrative review requests that are now beyond the 60-day mark has increased to 29. So you can see just vacancies in board members does have an effect on that. The board has worked closely with the governor's office to appoint board members with legal backgrounds and who could substantially help address this deficiency. And I can tell you, coming from the Department of Justice, that I'm ready to hit the ground running with respect to administrative review requests so that we don't find ourselves in this position again. I'll discuss a little later the board also plans to use the Department of Administrative Services, a DAS audit, as an opportunity to also to retool itself so that this measure may be met in the future.
Mr. Powers said briefly, the administrative review requests, are those primarily of that work that's actually being done by the board members themselves, as
yes.
opposed to the staff?
Chair Shields, my understanding is that primarily it's been done by board members.
So you actually sit down and type up the response to all of the...
Yeah, reviewing the file, looking at it, and then there are some other technical aspects as far as putting together the actual sheet and sending it out, but as far as the drafting of it, it has been all done by board members, is my understanding.
You'll be happy to know, Stephen, that Darcy's behind you going, yes.
Thank you.
Please continue.
I'll now turn to the four key performance measures that were met by the board. First, key performance measure number two, which now on page 8 of the notebook or on page 2 of the appendix. This measures the percentage of offenders being released from prison where the board's order of supervision has been received by the Community Corrections Office on or before the offender's release date from prison. It's a reflection of the board collaborating with our partners in the criminal justice system and making sure that these orders of supervision conditions have been actually received by the people who will be seeking to enforce them or review to make sure that they're being enforced. Another key performance measure that was met was number 4, the percentage of warrants received by the board in which the warrant issued within 5 days. Again, this is a measure of the board's responsiveness to public safety concerns in collaboration with our partners in community corrections around the state, and that the board gets these warrants out within 5 days to address public safety concerns. Third, KPM number 5, which measures the percentage of revocations for offenders who violate their conditions of parole and post-prison supervision. This measure reflects the effective use of sanctions and decisions by the board for offenders who violate their orders of supervision conditions. When an offender violates a condition, the board evaluates the appropriateness of the offender remaining in the community, and if so, imposes a sanction to protect the public and meet the offender's needs. The goal of this measure is to have a small percentage of revocations compared to a large percentage of sanctions, showing that community corrections and the board are collaborating to improve both punitive and reformative sanctions to address the offender's behavior while keeping that offender's transition into the community. Finally, the fourth measure that the board met was KPM number 6, which measures the percentage of expiration orders, either parole or post-prison supervision, that have been completed and mailed within 5 days of the offender's discharge from parole and post-prison supervision, again, just reflecting being a partner in getting those orders out in a timely fashion. Before I move to the agency priorities, I'll note that page 12 has KPM number 8, which will be used for the 06-07 to the measure the percentage of customers rating their satisfaction with the agency as good or excellent in various agency areas. Turning now to the agency division and priorities tab, on page 13 we've outlined our 7 statutory functions that guide the board's public safety mission. I won't go through each of them, but I'll sum it up by saying to work effectively, the board's the public safety system requires a balance among law enforcement, prosecution, adjudication, corrections, and paroling authorities. And so in carrying out the 7 statutory functions, that's why the board is trying to be a strong partner with its other public safety agencies. The page 14 just describes that the board is not separated into different divisions. It is one program, and there are the sub-programs, and we've listed them there in priority order. They reflect what I've already described as far as the board's 3 general responsibilities and then some of its individual ones, including administrative review, what you see on there, and how the FTE and budget is broken out on there. the other things we'll note on page 14 is that the BAM LFO form is Appendix B, and the House Bill 3182 reductions is Appendix C. So the last tab, the quality efficiency improvements, again, as Doug mentioned, there are no policy option packages, but the board has identified two quality improvement efficiency concepts. One is the Attorney General retainer agreement to help stabilize and our AG expenses, as I've discussed, we're going to work with the Attorney General beginning in the 07-09 biennium to have a retainer agreement so that we could have a more even sense of what our legal costs are actually going to be. And then the second one is the DAS audit and organizational review that is mentioned there on page 16. That is continuing on, and there's still we don't have the results of that, but once we do have the results, we will share our findings and recommendations with the DAS budget and management and the legislative fiscal office at some point once we get them. And then we might also be seeing some retooling of how the board does its work based on that audit. In closing, let me just say that I think it's fitting that the last topic points the board to the future. I started this presentation by taking you through a brief history of the Board of Parole and showing you our priorities for the next biennium. The DAS audit and organizational review will not only allow the board to identify efficiencies and to examine its processes for the upcoming biennium, but we hope it will lay the groundwork for moving the board forward to carrying out its public safety mission into the future. Again, thank you, Chair Shields, and members of the subcommittee for the opportunity to appear before you today, even though I won't take my position until next week. I'm happy to entertain any questions or at least defer them to my colleagues behind me.
Well, Mr. Powers, I appreciate you stepping into the to make the presentation so early. You did a very nice job, and we very much appreciate it. Questions? Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the situation. It's described on page 6 under professional services and purchasing contracts that you have intergovernmental agreements with 12 counties. And I understand that new in the position, you may not have enough information or certainly not officially the direct experience to have an opinion or suggestion at this time. But what I'm thinking about is what is the appropriate venue for activities to take place? And it's not only in this agency, but in many agencies. There are some things done at the state level and some things done by counties. And in this instance, there are intergovernmental agreements to do something that otherwise would be done at a central or your location. So that leads me to the question. Well, first, it's just a detailed point. The activities that are happening in these counties that you have the IGAs with, are the statistics included in what we see reflected under the performance measure results? Or are they counted along with your work, even though the work is happening somewhere else, when we're counting activity?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, the county holds the hearing on whether maybe for revocation or something like that. And that does, as my understanding is, yes, those, whatever the decision is made after that, and that comes up to the board, and the board actually ultimately makes a decision on the sanction will be 60 days, it will be revocation. And so that is included in the numbers that we have provided you.
Good. So where is it appropriate to do this? Is this the fact that there are IGAs, so that some of this activity is happening in counties, was that out of necessity? Is it because it's better to do it in the counties, or a better way to provide the service? Was it a budget decision or an operational or service-type decision? Should we see more of that, or in an optimal world, should we see less of that?
Chair Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson. I don't have an opinion on and a full understanding of all our IGAs. I can say that these hearings are, you know, required by law and need to happen in a timely and efficient manner. And I pulled just the list of how many hearings that they completed or projected for 05-07. It's like 3,800 hearings. We have, the board has one hearing officer on staff that does the remaining hearings. If, you know, the appropriateness, again, I'm not sure where it's going to be. The hearing has to happen, and who should be using that, or if you'd be closer to the county community corrections or at the board. It's certainly something that we'd like to look into. We will look into and maybe have a better answer than that. But I will say that there are, you know, if there aren't these intergovernmental agreements, I think there is more cost, as I understand it, of having the hearings officer at the board and doing hearings out in Klamath and Lake and Lane, and where we've had some of where we do have current IGAs right now, and that there is a cost savings to it. Whether that was the ultimate driver of it, I'm not sure, but we can definitely look into that.
Thank you. Two quick questions. I found it interesting that the recidivism rate for the indeterminate sentencing structure was considerably less than the determinate sentencing structure. Do you have any speculation on why that might be? Or does anyone, staff, those?
Chair Shields, I don't have any speculation on why, you know, it's down, the recidivism rate is less for the matrix offenders. But let me defer to
Chair Shields, members of the committee. I think perhaps our recidivism rate is lower because these people have to work harder to get release. They have been incarcerated longer. They have to demonstrate to the board that it's appropriate to release them. And also hanging over their head is the promise that if they violate, that they can come back to prison, and many of them for a very long time. And once they get the privilege of release into the community, many of them take that seriously.
Great, thank you. And then the last question I had is, I just wanted to address what potentially could be a duplication of service. That it seems to me that if DOC is doing inmate transition plans and then you're reviewing them, is that something from statutory authority that it check and balance to make sure that the DOC is actually doing these on, and you're advocating on behalf of the community? Is that the kind of the rationale, or maybe you can help me understand that?
Chair Shields, my understanding, and my colleagues will correct me as I go forward, is statutory required that we review those. And it also ties into us issuing orders of supervision conditions, and so with the release plans. But there might be more to it than that. More to add, Darcy.
More. The release plans are started in the institution. The offender presents information to their release counselor, which is then sent out to the field for the field officer to take a look at and make any recommendations for supervision. And then it comes to the board, and we have the final authority in terms of what conditions will be imposed. So we look at what the PO is recommending. We may also be hearing from victims, and that could have an impact on conditions that we are imposing. There may be other factors that we're considering, and so that's why we have the final authority.
Can you speak closer to the microphone?
Oh, certainly.
Thank you.
And you do that for indeterminate, determinate, every offender coming out of the
Every offender coming out of the institution, and also for every offender who has been sanctioned locally in the community to a revocation, we are required to prepare a new order of supervision for them as well. And a release plan needs to be generated for that.
Okay. Great. I mean, it makes sense that to make sure that those are actually happening and that there's a check and balance in the system. Representative Camergan.
Quick question, and I'm not sure who would want to answer this, but on the new performance, the KPM number 8,
and it's talking about collecting data from the customers. Who have you identified as the customers that we're getting that satisfaction data from?
Representative Cameron and members of the committee, Department of Justice, and also...
Close to the microphone, please.
Okay, Department of Justice. Steve. Department of Justice and Public Defender's Office.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Did a great job. Thank you very much, Mr. Powers. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And then we're going to open it up to public testimony. First up, Steve Dole. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon and a co-victim of a violent crime. In October of 1992, my 12-year-old daughter Lisa was murdered by a violent teenager, a stranger to her, as she walked home from from the school bus to her grandparents' home. After that, I became involved first with Parents of Murdered Children and then in 1994 with Crime Victims United of Oregon. In 1983, members of Parents of Murdered Children founded Crime Victims United to advance the rights of crime victims and enhance the safety of all law-abiding Oregon citizens by addressing problems in Oregon's criminal justice system. Through the tireless efforts of many volunteers, most of them victims of violent crime, Crime Victims United has worked with the Oregon legislature on laws to protect the rights of crime victims and enhance public safety. Today, Crime Victims United is here in support of the proposed budget for the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. A very important component of the board, as new chair spoke to, is the victim services provided by the board. Oregon statutes require the board to notify victims requesting notification in writing prior to board hearings and release from an institution. In fact, that is part of the constitutional rights and the crime victims' rights. In addition to these statutory requirements, the board has devoted their efforts to provide advocate duties for victims and their families within the criminal justice system. Victims are invited to be involved whenever possible in the decision-making process of the board. The board's victim specialist, Debbie Wojciechowski, prepares victims for hearings, attends the hearings with the victims, guides them through the board hearing process, and debriefs the victims following the hearings. And I'm very familiar with this process because often I have attended these hearings with the victim's family. Mary Elledge, who is the chapter leader of Parents of Murdered Children, was originally not going to be able to be here today, so she asked me to kind of combine our testimony. However, she is here and is going to have some additional comments, but I would like to, with your permission, I would like to read something into the record just to give you all a sense of what victims go through in dealing with parole decisions and the parole board. And I would say this, based on the earlier comments, remember this, that it's been 17 years now since we've had a matrix system. We went from the matrix system where the Board of Parole had control over these inmates to the sentencing guidelines and then to a small portion of crimes, the first and second degree violent crimes, which is Measure 11. These people, in many cases, are the worst of the worst. That's why they're still there, and that's why they're under the control of the board. And this case, I think, demonstrates the type of person that we're dealing with. The family of Bethy Curran has appeared before the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision 8 times. Nothing they do or say will bring back their 18-month-old daughter, Elizabeth K. Curran. Bethy was murdered by inmate Elvin Reeve when he smothered Bethy while attempting to engage in sexual intercourse. Semen was found on Bethy even though he bathed her after the murder in an attempt to cover the crime. It is very painful for Bethy's family to appear before the board. They must listen each time to Elvin Reeves' lies as he speaks before the Board of Parole. Families relive the murder of their child even without this happening. Seeing Reeve and listening to him still deny that he sexually abused Bethy is a nightmare for the little girl's family. They have been dealing with the brutal murder and sexual abuse for over 20 years. Bethy was murdered on March 2nd of 1985. As a circuit court judge for the last 15, Judge Daryl Larson was the district attorney in this case. Each time Reeve goes before the board, Larson takes the time to write to the board to let them know his concerns about inmate Reeve being released. In his last letter to the board, he wrote, "As a circuit court judge for the last 15 years, I know that anyone who suggests that your decisions are easy does not understand the complete context of your duties. However, there are some offenders who have committed crimes which loudly and unmistakably announce their danger to society. I must conclude that inmate Reeve and his crime are one such example." Judge Larson is absolutely right. Not only does the board have to consider the danger to society, they have laws and rules that must be considered so their decision is not overturned. The Greater Portland Chapter is grateful for the research and time the board members spent on Bethy's case. They were not fooled by Reeve's lies or denials. Debbie Wojciechowski, victim assistance clerk, was very helpful in understanding with the family. She did her best to consider any need that they may have. Tracy and Robert Bow and family members who have appeared over the years to keep inmate Reeve from harming other children are true heroes. I have the honor to tell their story for the last three hearings. The pain each of them experiences as they go into each hearing is evident. They are always there. They always bring a picture of Bethy. There is not a time that it does not take my breath away. Those who have faced the murder of a small child know this all too well. All co-victims relive the murder of their loved one. That fact and that they want justice and protection for society truly exemplifies their resiliency and bravery. The Baugh-Kern family will be back in 2 years. They have given Bethy a voice. The Greater Portland Chapter is so proud of them. We are also grateful to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, Debbie Wojciechowski, Judge Larson, and all who helped bring justice and protection to society. This is just one example of the importance of services provided by the board to crime victims and to their families. The board works together with victims' advocates, fostering an open and cooperative environment that encourages effective communications in support of victims. These victim services provide continuity, assurance, and a voice for victims, co-victims, and victims' advocates. And I cannot say enough for the work of these people because, again, as Darcy Baker would tell you, we're working on a couple of cases right now, and they're bad cases. Crime Victims United strongly recommends that this committee and the legislature approve the board's budget and allow them to continue their services to victims and to their families. And I very much appreciate your time and consideration, and I will answer any questions that you may have.
Questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Bill.
Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Ellidge, would you like to say some words?
Please make sure you speak right into the microphone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Anytime you're ready.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you all for listening to us. My name is Mary Ellidge, and I'm chapter leader of the Greater Portland Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide. I have been chapter leader for over 17 years, and 2 years before that, excuse me, I was president of Crime Victims United. I would like to give you a little update on the case that Steve just said. On February 21st, I will be back with the Curran family with Bethy's picture to try to keep this man in longer. What I don't think was mentioned in Steve's article in his reading was that this man also tries to insult the mother of Bethy's mother, that she was an unfit mother when he's supposed to be speaking, which the parole board does not allow. Can you hear me? Oh, thank you. I'm losing my voice. Am I speaking loud enough?
Great. Doing
thank
great.
You. As I said, I have been chapter leader for 17 years. 20 years ago, our only son was brutally murdered in our home. He was murdered by a man who was supposed to be his best friend. He was a young man that went to school with Rob's older sister, and who was actually 3 years older than Rob. And 3 days before he hired the murderers of my son, he came to our house to visit, and he said to me, "What are you going to be doing this weekend?" And I said, "Well, we're going to be out of town." He goes, "Oh, I did not know that I was telling him that we would be gone and that he would be the man that would hire two other men to come in and murder our son." And so Rob had no, or not, none of us had any idea that what he was capable of. It was my first experience with dealing with a sociopath that was that vicious. He lured Rob from the home, and Tony brought these two men back to break into the house until Rob came back. When Rob walked in the front door, the one man that he hired hit him with a baseball bat several times on his head and crushed his skull. Rob was still living, and the doctor who did the autopsy said he probably lived for 45 minutes. The next, he had his cousin, was the other man he hired. He had him strangle Rob with the telephone cord from our phone and inject him with a horse tranquilizer. So 40 minutes later, our son was dead. But that isn't just what they did. They took his body from the house and buried him in a shallow grave 10 miles from our home and cleaned up the mess that they thought they had cleaned it all up. And that night when we came back from the beach, the phone was ringing. It was Tony saying he was waiting to find Rob. And he was supposed to, Rob was supposed to meet him at a certain point, and Rob never showed up. He's that good of a liar. And he came over the next day and said, "I wonder where he is." For 6 weeks, we looked for our son. We were just desperate because he had never, ever been away from home without letting us know. And he had a wonderful girlfriend. And the detectives got involved. Well, we were lucky to find a couple spots of blood underneath the threshold of the door that they'd forgot to wipe up. And so that was when we could call the police in. Then it was in the paper that the young man was missing, and there was evidence of foul play. And the stepmother of one of the other boys, not Tony, heard him bragging to a person that he had killed a young man, and she turned him into the police. So the police, the detectives arrested these two men and were able to get them to tell the truth. But in all these years, Tony has never said he did it, but he was, after 8 months later, they were able to arrest him. They had enough evidence on him. He is still saying at all the parole hearings that he did not do it, that the other men did it, and he had, wasn't involved. He is an ideal prisoner. If it were not for this parole board, he would be out right now because he is so good in prison. But he's not going to be bad at any place where he's going to get in trouble for. If he's bad in prison, he'll have things taken away from him, so he's not stupid. A sociopath will not do anything to harm himself, and he knows what he did. When we went through the trials, we had many hearings and trials to go to because of the three men. And as I would walk in the courtroom and he would be sitting up with his attorney, he would look over and say, "Hello, Mary," just to try to taunt us. And he would call us on the phone all the time the 8 months he was out. So it was an eye-waking, besides the worst thing in the world happiness, to lose a child in that manner, and to have your whole life turned upside down. And as you all would probably realize by now, and most people know, and some people I guess don't, that homicide cannot be resolved. It can't be compensated. It is probably the worst way. Specialists in the field feel it's one of the worst ways to lose a loved one because of this. And the parole board is so valuable to all of us, and we hope that you will go along with their budget, because it gives co-victims of homicide, as well as victims of all crime, a chance to come in and tell their story so that they get a true understanding what happens. And in homicide, the victims can't talk, so we as a family will come in, even though it's very, very hard. As I have said, I've been into the parole board 9 times just for our family, and I was treated with respect and allowed to talk. And they do have respect for the prisoners, too. I mean, we are not allowed to insult them or get into their face. So it's really run very well. Parents of murdered children have been very appreciative of the parole board. They'll come to our meetings and talk with us when we need them to. They'll answer questions. Debbie, who is the victim assistant, is totally outstanding. So from our point of view, I hope that you will approve their budget. And if there's any questions, I would be more than happy to answer anything.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you. And thank you for the water.
Thank you very much. Richard Sly. Ready when you are.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the subcommittee. My name is Richard Sly, and I'm here wearing two hats, or in two roles, one as a member of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, the folks that operate the parole and probation departments statewide, and in my own position as the director at Yamhill County Community Correction. Interesting to listen to your dialogue with the witnesses over some of these issues. And not so easy to follow such a compelling story as the two folks that preceded me. I'm here, obviously, in support of the budget request for the board. I have a fairly lengthy history doing this type of work. I worked for 20 years as an adult parole and probation officer in McMinnville, where I've worked for 10 additional years as the director and served a part-time, 10-year service on the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board. So have some experience in dealing with the board like the Board of Parole. As you've heard, and it's certainly true, this group of folks deal with the worst offenders that go through the Oregon trial courts and end up in our prisons. They're the highest risk of offenders with the most serious crimes, and just by reason of the way the felony sentencing guidelines are designed, these are the folks that fall over the dispositional line and go to prison. And of course there's a group of matrix offenders that you've heard about that are doing a lot of time. Today I think there's about 13,350 prisoners in our institution, and one way or another, was explained earlier, those folks are going to be reviewed by this panel of three folks who set conditions and, in some cases, the matrix cases, order their release. But the job doesn't stop there. They also have an obligation, or jurisdiction maybe is a better word, to follow these folks while they're in the community. And I can tell you on a day-to-day basis, I comment in my letter that they have sort of an on-the-spot review, and I would respectfully disagree with the chair on one point. He said that they, meeting their benchmarks, get warrants out in 5 days. I have a person that I'm supervising, and I know I'll submit the electronic request, and it's not unusual to get it in 2 days. It's just an extremely fast turnaround, and that's very helpful when the officer in the field is reporting violation behavior that might be drug use or somebody that's spinning out of control. Small agency, but very efficient. And they really do attend to a priority on public safety issues. The board also has a role as a state agency and a part of the executive department to sort of make, no disrespect, decisions on high, which have a policy implication for all of us. Every one of the counties has a different philosophical approach to groups like sex offenders, for example. And the board sometimes, in having the ability to consider these policy issues, are able to make a well-considered opinion that works well in urban America as well as it does in rural America. With the sex offender population, that's certainly been true, and the designation of the predatory offenders as well as the extensive job of knocking on doors for the notification process. So we receive lots and lots of technical assistance from the board. I think it goes without saying that you've heard in the very compelling testimony that the board has an excellent history of stewardship when it comes to victims issue, and I can tell you as a person working in the field that that's very, very genuine and very true. I think that concludes the remarks, except for what I've mentioned in my letter. I, too, appreciate the opportunity to be asked to testify and consider it a privilege to come here and do so. And I wonder if I could touch on two of the questions that came up earlier. I'll be very brief. You mentioned the hearings and the IGAs. The structure of corrections in Oregon gives a lot of emphasis on local control. So you'll have little jails, big jails, medium-sized jails, and the ability for some of the counties that you mentioned, Representative Nathanson, on IGAs for hearings, that enables the locals to be able to do their hearings, go over, and it saves the board that extra work, which is, in many instances, it's the Morrissey hearing, the due process hearing that all parolees are able to receive, so that the problem solving happens between the PO or a supervisor that's known to the offender, and it's an efficiency, I think I would mention. And there was also a question about pre-release and transition. And in the parlance of community corrections, the pre-release investigation is a staple of our work, so that if Representative Hanna is a prisoner and he's going to be released to our county, we're going to get his plan and go out and verify his residence. We're going to make sure that he's welcome there, that there aren't victim issues there, no disrespect, sir, and make sure that it's a workable plan. And we'll report that back to the board with any conditions we believe that local law enforcement or the family should be, that we would recommend to them to attend to his order. The pre-release or transition work that the Department of Corrections is doing is quite a different practice, which is to ready prisoners for the very difficult transition from the institution, to make sure that they have some job skills, that they know how to apply for a position, that they're connected with alcohol and drug programs, those sorts of things. So it isn't really duplication. Thank you for the chance to speak to you.
Yeah, sure. So just so that I understand, the Department of Corrections, in your experience, doesn't make recommendations on living conditions or do that kind of legwork. That happens at the local community level or with the parole board.
We're effectively the Department of Corrections in the field. So we would go to Representative Hanna's proposed residence and verify there is a house there, and there isn't always a house. And check that all out. So, indeed.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Any questions?
Thank you. I just want to know what crime Representative Hanna has committed that we're.
He's like an old Coke truck.
I'll leave that alone. All right. Any other questions? We thank you very much for coming in, for your testimony. It's much appreciated and really helped inform our discussion. This meeting is adjourned.